Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. An award-winning political cartoonist, Rob Rogers is known for his ability to lampoon power figures and make cartoons that are both funny and biting. Rogers is also known as the cartoonist who was fired from his job at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette after the paper stopped publishing his cartoons, taking aim at President Trump. Since then, Rogers has had a book published that includes not only his cartoons, but the story of his demise at the Post-Gazette in 2018 and what he's been doing since then. Rob Rogers joins us in the studio. Rob Rogers, thank you for coming in to talk with us.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
In your book, you take aim at the publisher of the Post-Gazette, J.R. Block, and you write and draw that the paper was always kind of left-leaning, but he stayed out of the editorial side of things, kind of viewing it from afar until Donald Trump entered the picture. And you have his drawings of the publisher with a bow tie. Mm-hmm. He's kind of harmless looking. And then eventually, though, he turns into a part of a character out of the movie Mad Max.
Was
it cathartic for you to draw that?
Yeah, I mean, most people would have, you know, gone into therapy, but I just draw, you know, that's kind of what happens. But no, it was. It was very cathartic to write that comic strip. The Mad Max from Thunderdome, it was, what was the character called now? Oh, Master Blaster, right. I almost forgot. And he was the master. And in the movie, the master is this small little guy, and he sits on the shoulders of this big hulking guy who doesn't have much of a brain, right? And so the master is the brains, and the blaster is the enforcer. It just struck me that way because originally I was calling Keith Burris, the new editor, who he brought in to kind of get me in line. I was calling him the fixer, the Michael Cohen of the PG. But when I was drawing the comic, that wasn't as funny as using that old movie reference, although maybe some people won't even know the movie. So
I think you could appreciate the cartoon without even knowing the specific Mad Max reference, because you get the idea that there's a mini me.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's right. And the funny thing was, the blaster wears this helmet, so you never really see his face. So I didn't even have to draw Keith Burris. I just drew the helmet.
And you also draw yourself, too, in some of the pictures. You're curled up on a ball in the floor, and it looks like you're sweating in fear, maybe. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the panel where I'm in the fetal position because my editor of 12 years, Tom Wasileski, who was the best editor I ever had, great guy, he took a buyout and left the paper instead of agreeing to endorse Trump. And, you know, he was arguing with the publisher that, you know, nothing we've written over the last 30 years would agree with anything that Trump is doing. You know, this is going to be a hard sell. We can't really make this switch. And they went at it, you know, for several months. And finally, he just said, I can't do it anymore.
And that's when things changed for you, too, that there started to be more oversight of your cartoons.
Well, yes, there already was a little bit of pressure from the publisher, but the editor was on my side. So what was nice was he was my buffer, and that's why I'm curled up in the fetal position, because I realized I would no longer have a buffer. Now, fortunately, the one who took his place, John Allison, was also a very good, you know, liberal-minded, I should say he's more of a moderate, but he's very fair-minded, and he likes my cartoons. And so he was the interim editorial page editor or the replacement for Tom. And so that went for 2 years. So I actually had John as my buffer, and he was great too. But I was getting more and more pressure from the publisher to go easy on Trump, and I had a hard time doing that. I was hired to have my own opinions and to draw what I felt was the important issue and take the side of whatever I thought was important. And so this was one of the first times in my entire career where I had somebody telling me, well, we don't like that opinion and we don't want you to draw that. It never happened before.
I could see the counter argument, someone saying, well, you are left-leaning, you're having a liberal opinion, and we need to have equality at the newspaper and represent all points of view, so we don't want to just have every political cartoon be left-leaning.
Well, yes, and so I gave them a list of syndicated cartoonists that they could run on the page when I'm not in there. I even suggested, you know, possibly moving my cartoon to the op-ed page with my name is still on it, and people could still find it very easily, but then run a conservative cartoon, a syndicated cartoon on the editorial page, which was more in line with where they wanted to take the paper. Because I agree, yes, it's their newspaper, and they have the right to say whatever they want and hire whoever they want. But the problem was they wanted to change me, and that was an issue, and I didn't like it, and so I wasn't willing to just do it. It's not as if, you know, I was working, say, you know, in one part of the office, you know, like let's say I was cleaning the office and I was working in one office cleaning and then they moved me to another one. It's not that easy. It's not something that I could just say, oh, sure, I'll go do that.
I think you make the point in your book that you wouldn't ask George Will, a conservative columnist, to write a liberal column.
Exactly. Yeah, that was Tom Wasileski who made that point, my old editor. So he makes that point very well. And really, they did have other, you know, they did have other columnists that they syndicated that were more conservative, and they certainly could have done that as well. It just was the idea of asking me to sort of change my moral stand and change my integrity to just draw whatever they wanted. I wasn't hired to be an illustrator.
J.R. Block told Politico that you'd become too angry for your health or for your own good, and that you were obsessed with Trump.
No more than I was obsessed with Bill Clinton when I was drawing cartoons about him. It just so happens that Trump can't help himself in terms of being in the center of the news every single day. Now, granted, I would have a meeting with John Block and we would agree. The one thing we could agree on is we don't have to make Trump the cartoon every day. You know, so I said I can draw other issues, and I did. I did a lot of things about gun control, and I did local cartoons. There was a lot more in there, but even though I was only doing around two cartoons a week on Trump, he was giving me material for like 17, but I was only doing two, and then they were still problematic.
You eventually left the paper because they offered you a buyout. It came to a head where they stopped publishing your cartoons, and then they offered you a buyout, and you said no, and that was it?
Well, it didn't. That's not exactly how it happened. I didn't leave the paper. I was fired. What they did was, after 3 months of killing my cartoons, they killed six in a row. And they wouldn't give me any explanation. I was contacting them every day through email and telephone, and they wouldn't respond. And so I, you know, finally, after a week of that, after those killed cartoons went on for a week, they contacted me and said, well, we have a new contract that we want you to sign. It's a working guidelines contract. And I was an at-will employee. I wasn't a part of the guild because my position had been exempt years before.
Not unionized.
Yeah, non-union. So I was an at-will employee, which means they could let me go anytime. And so what they did was they offered me this contract, which suddenly changed my job description. And it put it more in line with what they wanted, which was you will collaborate, or actually you'll do cartoons by committee, which is what it essentially said, with the publisher and the editor involved, the new editor, Keith Burris. And I knew that was a recipe for disaster. And that was only one of the new points that they wanted to make. They also were asking me to sign this statement that said I was too angry, which which was just ridiculous. So
too angry to decide upon your own cartoons.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. They wanted me to admit that I was too angry in writing. And I was like, who signs something like this? Nobody. I can't believe this is actually happening. So I wrote back to them. I was very nice. I said, I'm sorry, I can't put my signature on this. I said, if you want to talk about ways we could, you know, maybe adjust what I'm doing and my role at the paper and figure out a way to get more conservative views on the page from other people, I can help facilitate that. I said, I really just want to keep drawing, and I have a lot of readers out there who want me to keep drawing. And at this point, the readers were reacting because they had killed a week worth of cartoons in a row, and they were wondering what was happening. And the news outlets started calling and started saying, hey, what's going on?
Right, it hit the national news.
Yeah. Yeah, at this point, it had hit the national news. You know, people were calling and trying to find out what was going on. But up to that point, up until I got that contract from them, I hadn't talked to the media. I had only confirmed what had been written on Facebook that, yes, they had killed the cartoons. Like, it's not that I wasn't drawing. So I confirmed that. But then after I got the contract, I realized they're not serious about negotiating with me. They just want me to either leave or get in line. And so I agreed to go on Jake Tapper at that point.
Also a cartoonist. He's a CNN anchor, but also a cartoonist on the side.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. He actually worked as a political cartoonist for The Hill before he became a broadcast journalist. So he was quite suited to be the first interview for me.
And your book includes a section of those cartoons that got spiked. Mm-hmm. And in the cartoon telling the story of how your job there ended, you said, "Now I'm unemployed, but on the bright side, there's no one left to reject my cartoons." Is that your way kind of finding solace in humor?
Yes, because and if you see the gag, it's actually not really true, because readers are still chiming in and saying, you know, "I reject that cartoon," you know. But it is true that I have more freedom now, and I do know. I do notice it, and I can feel it. The one thing I would say, though, is after working 34 years with an editor and some very good editors who I worked with very well, unlike what the Post Gazette was portraying, that I wasn't
that you were willing, difficult, yeah,
that
and
I
angry,
was, yeah, difficult and angry. I do miss that back and forth. I do miss the ability to sort of show something to an editor and say, "Am I on the mark here, or am I in my own little world, you know, thinking about this? Does it get the point across that I want to get across?" Or, you know, because oftentimes, you know, over the years, I've been saved many times from doing something that would have sent the wrong message, you know. And he would say, "Well, you know, is this really what you want to say? Or are you trying to say this over here?" And also just, you know, spelling errors and other things that I've been sort of saved from. So I do miss having an editor, but I will say that I don't miss having the last editor that I had.
So you're not in a newsroom anymore, but still continuing with the work. And it sounds like you got a lot of support from readers, too. Did you hear feedback? Is people saying, "Hey, where are your cartoons? What's happening?"
Yeah, when the cartoons were being killed, I got tons of support, including online, you know, from people I didn't even know, including people like George Takei and Barbara Streisand chiming in on my plight. And that sort of turned itself into a larger following on Twitter and on Facebook. And so what's been great is that those fans are still out there, and they're supporting me in all kinds of ways. One of those ways is I started a Patreon page, which is a sort of a crowdfunding service for artists and musicians. And that's been very, very successful in terms of, you know, getting that up and going.
You pointed out, and we talked about this briefly, that even though you're left-leaning, more liberal, that you're pretty equal opportunity when it came to lampooning politicians. Just to give one example, there's one of Bill Clinton, and he's standing naked at the podium giving mm-hmm. the State of the Union, and he says, "Did I mention the economy is going great?" Because,
right,
of course, he's in his own political morass, and he can't get out of it.
Yeah. You know, I used to have readers complain that, especially right after Clinton, when I was drawing cartoons about George W. Bush, they complained that you didn't treat Clinton like that. And I said, "Well, you haven't seen all of them." And so I would send them like five or six samples, and they'd be like, "Oh, okay." Yeah, now granted, you know, in the case of George W. Bush, you know, he started two wars, so I had a lot to draw about with him. Trump, I have even more to draw about with him. It's clear that when I agree with a president or agree with their policies, I'm not going to have as much to criticize. And with Clinton, even though I had him, you know, I had the Monica Lewinsky thing, I also was criticizing Newt Gingrich, who was his sworn enemy and, you know, sort of the Republican Revolution man. So, you know, I did give equal time, but I do think that, you know, sometimes people see, just because I'm a liberal, that I don't ever go after Democrats, and that's not true. I mean, even on the campaign trail, I did cartoons critical of Hillary.
Right. There's another one of Bill and Hillary Clinton, and they're in a raft, and it's, of course, a lampoon of them for the whole Whitewater scandal,
right,
and they're going off a cliff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And she's saying, "I don't see this on the map anywhere."
Right. 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 Well, that's one of the things I really enjoyed about the book, in your cartoons and your commentary on it is it was almost like a snapshot of history. Some of the events, like, oh yeah, I remember that when Bill Clinton was caught in that morass and the shenanigans they were involved in. Or there was a picture of Dan Quayle and he's like riding on a little kid's toy.
Oh, yeah.
And and the Bush, of course, is pondering sending him to the moon or sending him into outer space. So it's almost like you do get that kind of look back in time.
Yeah, it is. It was kind of fun to go back and pull those cartoons out and say, oh yeah, I remember this. But that's kind of the crazy thing is here I am for 34 years because I started, you know, I had 25 years at the Post-Gazette, but I started at the Pittsburgh Press for 9 years. And through all that time, I was drawing presidents. And so now suddenly I'm not allowed to draw the president. You know, that just doesn't make sense to me.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Rob Rogers, an award-winning political cartoonist. Rogers lost his job at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette last year, but his cartoons continue on robrogers.com. You write in your book that you started drawing as a child, getting in trouble for drawing on the wall of your apartment, the apartment where you were growing up. Did you always do cartoon-style drawings? Were you naturally drawn to that, or did you do a variety of different types of drawing and painting but kind of circle back to that?
Yeah, that's pretty much what happened. I started with cartooning. Like, from the time I was a kid, I don't remember not doing cartoons. And I would sit on the floor and copy them out of the Sunday Funnies. And then later, in junior high, I started getting into fine art. And I started, you know, I took a class and I was drawing, you know, figure drawings and still life and all that. And that sort of led to me going into being an art major in college. And the funny thing was, when I got to college, my professor was encouraging me to kind of break away from the cartoony looking people I was drawing. And so I was able to make this sort of divide between my fine art and my cartoons. And so I kept them kind of separate. But I was always sort of doing cartoons for the school paper and then doing the fine art on the side. And then I eventually went to Carnegie Mellon to get a master's in painting. And at that point, I didn't even tell my professors that I was a cartoonist because I knew that it was a lesser art form.
Was it frowned upon a little bit?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was back in the 80s. So of course, you know, it wasn't thought of as the fine art that it has now become recognized as in some circles.
Were you always interested in politics, too? Because it's one thing to be a cartoonist and an illustrator. Yeah. But obviously, if you're a political cartoonist, you have to be drawn to the politics of it.
Right. And that didn't happen right away. I was more interested in the humor and the drawing. When I look back at some of the stuff I did as a kid, I sort of had the comic timing down. And that was really unusual. I looked at it. I went back and looked at it when I was in my 30s. And I was like, wow, I kind of had that already. So that was kind of neat to see. But the politics took a while. And you know, I can think back to times in my life where my father tried to influence me a little bit. You know, he sat me down in the 70s and forced me to watch the Watergate hearings, and I was bored out of my mind. I had no idea why I was watching this. And now, you know, in retrospect, I'm like, wow, I wish I had paid attention to that. You know, it was on live TV, and there was no cable at that time.
Childhood's wasted on the young.
Yeah, it really is. So that was one thing. And there were a couple of other moments in you know, presidential history that I remember my dad watching the elections when Nixon won. And so there's a couple of other times when I was aware of what was going on. But no, I wasn't very political. And then when I got into college and started drawing for the school paper, most of the issues were campus related, right? So there wasn't a lot you had to take a stand on, really. But I did start noticing as I was doing these cartoons that, okay, well, I have to figure out how I feel about this. And once I started doing it daily for the Pittsburgh Press, I was forced to really examine how I felt about these things. And it didn't take long to really figure it out. But in the beginning, I think I was more of a moderate, and I was just sort of looking for what was funny. And I was kind of going for the gag. You know, sometimes trying to be insightful, but mostly trying to create. It was more about the craft of creating a good cartoon, a funny cartoon, and it wasn't as much about what do I want to say.
Your opinion on it.
Yeah, right. And that was okay because in the beginning I was working for a more conservative paper at the time. It was the Pittsburgh Press was a Scripps Howard paper, and they're more conservative. So that worked out fine for me in the beginning. And then as I started to get more liberal, fortunately, I had a good editor. And he was like, you know, he's like, well, you know, that's not in line with what the paper believes, but I'm going to let you go ahead with that, you know, because I think you should have the freedom to say what you want.
I think it's really amazing, though, to be able to come up with these ideas every day. It's one thing to have a drawing every day or several drawings, but to have to come up with the theme and to say, do something that's funny, too, mm-hmm. the punchline in there that actually is funny. And I read that you said you get up, you read the newspaper, you kind of watch the news and start getting some ideas percolating. But how does it work? Do you just, does that kind of the ideas just start springing into your mind and you start drawing or?
No, it's kind of a process of rolling these topics over in my brain, and then trying to sort of bring out what makes it a unique topic and how I feel about it. You know, for instance, you know, let's say the Mueller report. You know, the thing that I had been saying all along was, and I'd heard other pundits say this too, is that the SDNY report or the investigation by the Southern District of New York is probably more important. So when I drew the cartoon, I would sort of have, you know, Trump looking at the Mueller report, but behind him, you know, here comes the other one that's really going to have an effect. I mean, it just depends on what the topic is, but I tend to write down a lot of topics and sort of look at them and see if there's any way I can combine any of them or just try to figure out what the metaphor is going to be, if it's something I can use, a pop culture reference or some other kind of thing. It's often kind of fun to bring two disparate ideas together.
Yeah, and I would describe your cartoon style, and I hope this doesn't sound like making light of it, but it's almost, they're very cute. They're having a certain very cute quality to it. And again, I mean that not in a bad way, but the characters all have a certain appeal to them, even the ones who are the more like nefarious characters. And I think it's kind of disarming.
It is disarming. And a friend of mine, Steve Brodner, described me as the sort of the Venus flytrap of cartoonists because he said that when you look at the image, it seems harmless and you want to read it and you want to look into it. You want to be invited into this cartoon. But then the actual content gets you. I thought that was a good description.
Yeah, exactly. There's one cartoon, and I think this was in the cartoons that were rejected section mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. your book, and it's in 2013, and it's Pope Benedict, and he's retiring, and you draw him as kind of this like crotchety old man with his cane, and he says, "Hey, you progressives, get off of my lawn."
Right. Yeah, that was one that was rejected. But there's another one in there where, you know, I mean, the other thing that happens is, you know, I've added color in recent years. And so the color is another thing that sort of invites you in that makes you feel safe. And there's another one of Pope Benedict that
also, actually ran.
Well, it started to run, like it was on the page and then they pulled it late at night. But it ended up getting picked up by USA Today a week later. It was him putting these little Easter eggs, hiding them in the grass, and they have little priest collars, and one of the bishops is saying it's the annual hiding of the pedophile priests. And this was supposed to run on Good Friday.
Oh.
And so my publisher said no. But the thing that's always fun when I show that cartoon is it's a very bucolic scene of the grass and the Easter colors and everything. And
kind of draws you in again.
Yeah,
it draws you in,
and then you see what the content is. You're like, ouch.
Right, it's very sharp. Or there's another one, and it seemed kind of prescient. I think you did it a few years ago, and it was President Trump and Putin, and they're celebrating New Year's together, and they almost have like their little smooch, the glass of champagne. And then there's Joe Public, I guess we'll call him, in the background. And he says, it may not be collusion, but it's still gross.
It's still gross, right? Actually, that you're right. That would be a great cartoon to run now because this is where we are. No collusion, but it's still gross.
And then you also do cartoons like other cartoonists, that ones that aren't really so much funny, but they're very razor sharp. Again, the pedophilia that has been an issue in the Catholic Church. Or there was another one I'm thinking of, and there was lifeguards and a child's body is washed on the beach. And it's, of course, about
the Syrian refugees. Yeah,
right.
About the boy that they found on the beach. But I sort of did because we were rejecting those refugees, the Republicans wouldn't take them in. So I just sort of used it as a reference because they were talking about they would test people that were immigrants coming into the country or anybody who wanted asylum. Using a Christian test or something. And so the Republicans are saying, well, it's okay. He wouldn't have passed the Christian test anyway.
How do you decide that it's okay to do a cartoon like that that's not really funny at all, that mm-hmm. without pushing readers away?
Well, I think that readers understand what the craft is, you know, what an editorial cartoon is supposed to be. And so they know that not everyone is going to be funny. I mean, after 9/11, I did very serious cartoons. There's not a lot you can joke about with that. And also, humor can be a vehicle to talk about very difficult things, as with the pedophilia cartoons. But I think in this case, there's also a seriousness to the issue that readers understand, and so they're willing to go there. And I think that, you know, once in a while I'll get a reader who says, "Hey, that's not funny." and I'll say, "I know it's not funny. It's not supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be poignant, and you're supposed to be outraged by the, you know, either whoever it is, the president or by the Republican Party, but you're not supposed to be laughing."
Right. And we talked about you losing your job at a newspaper, and there's also the larger issue of downsizing at newspapers. Mm-hmm. And you wrote in your book that you won't be the last cartoonist to get fired. In mm-hmm. the introduction, you actually wrote, "Strictly from an economic standpoint, I am surprised I lasted as long as I did." Mm-hmm. Do you think you and other cartoonists are going to be able to find these other outlets? Like, you've talked about the website. Is that going to be able to be a place for it?
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, the staff job is definitely sort of the unicorn of the past. It's not, you know, well, I don't know if that makes sense, that metaphor.
I think it does, yeah.
But in other words, there really aren't staff jobs anymore for cartoonists in the way there were when I started out. In fact, you know, there were over 200 staff jobs in the country when I got my job, because a lot of newspapers felt like the prestige of being a newspaper, we want to have our own cartoonist. And that has dwindled to like under 30.
Wow.
In the years since I got that job. So I do think that there are other avenues out there, and satire is so important right now that I think there will always be a place for it, and people can find ways to, you know, if they're creative, they can find ways to get funding for it if it's good satire.
And you also write in your book that the book itself isn't about you losing your job, but it's about what should be alarming to people. Mm-hmm. And on your firing, you wrote, "I'm proud of the work I've done. I wake up every morning excited to fight the good fight, to afflict the comfortable, to speak truth to power, and yes, to make people laugh. I love what I do, and I have no plans to stop now. I will begin by drawing Trump as a turnip." And there's a small drawing of President Trump in the form of a turnip.
That was in my introduction. So yeah, you'd have to read the whole introduction. And there's a story about how I was not the first cartoonist to be controversial in Pennsylvania. There was a cartoonist who used to draw the governor at the time. I think this was the early 1900s, Governor Pennypacker, and Samuel Pennypacker. And he didn't like it, so he used to draw him as a parrot. So he decided to outlaw cartoons depicting politicians as animals. And so the cartoonist's reaction was, "Hey, we're just going to draw you as vegetables then." So it never really worked. The ban on cartoons never really worked, but it was an interesting story. And so they drew Pennypacker as a turnip. That was one of the drawings, and it was a very funny drawing. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try drawing Trump as a turnip just because, you know. So I did.
Rob Rogers, thank you for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you.
Award-winning political cartoonist Rob Rogers is known for his ability to lampoon power figures and make cartoons that are both funny and biting. Rogers is also known as the cartoonist who was fired from his job at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette after the paper stopped publishing his cartoons poking fun at President Trump. Since then, Rogers has had a book published that includes not only his cartoons, but the story of his demise at the Post-Gazette in 2018 and what he's been doing since then. To hear this and other episodes of Take Note, go to WPSU.org. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.